vinyl resurgence. To us, vinyl never left.
Welcome in to the Vinyl Community Podcast.
Back in the building. Super excited. This is Concert Buddy. If you're familiar with the channel, I don't need to hear anything about me, but you do need to hear about my guest. And if you don't know my guest, you're about to know my guest. In a big and maybe intimate way, we'll see how it goes. But I am joined for this latest rendition of Mind of the Record Collector. No probing. The channel, if you're familiar or unfamiliar, is Vinyl Rewind. And host is Eric Calero. Am I saying that right, Eric?
Yeah,
Calero?
Man. Yeah, you got
awesome.
It.
Awesome. Eric, thanks for joining us, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
Cool. Well, obviously, we have one thing in common outside of being dashingly good looking guys is we do the YouTube thing. You do it better than I do. And I've been watching you for years. So I'm like super geeked to talk to you and kind of hear about your journey and all that kind of stuff. But let's just kick into it with that journey. When, why, the inspiration, think about starting a channel, because all my limited research shows it was 2011. Did I get that year right? Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's when it went live, but the seed was planted in like 2010. At the time, I'd been in LA for about 2 years. I came right as the Writers Guild of America went on strike. And so the whole town was kind of shut down. In terms of like, TV and theatrical, but I came down here for acting and stuff. So, I had been working up in San Francisco and I was attached to a film, like a $5 million picture. And then, they went with somebody else like a week before shooting. So I was like, all right, I'm done being up here. I'm going to go down to LA. And, there were still commercials going on. So I had booked some stuff like that, but sometimes my wires get a little crossed as we age.
Tell me about it.
That's when IMDb comes in handy. But basically, I had, let me just double check, because I don't want to I was on the Conan Tonight Show. Yeah, that would have been 2009.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's right. So right about that time, we also had the housing market crash and subsequent kind of recession going on. And I had this kind of regular, semi-regular gig on Conan's Tonight Show. But then obviously he got in that whole situation. And so basically he lost the show and subsequently I lost that job and there really wasn't a lot going on. So I was just getting a little frustrated and I talked to this gentleman who I would occasionally work out with at the CrossFit gym I was going to at the time. And he was not known to me, but everyone said, oh yeah, he was on the show Jag. So I was just like, well, what do you do in between acting gigs to kind of keep things, interesting for yourself? And he mentioned a couple things, but it got me thinking like, okay, I should take things into my own hands. At the time I was doing a lot of wedding videos. So I had equipment and I have a degree in filmmaking. So I'm like, okay, I have the means. There's this thing called YouTube. And at the time I was watching a lot of Angry Video Game Nerd and Nostalgia Critic. So I was inspired by all of that. I'm like, okay, what could I do? And as I was driving from LA to Santa Cruz, it's a long drive. It's about 3.5 hours straight in the middle of California on Highway 5. If you've ever driven it, but it gives you time to think. And so that's the genesis of the show was like, okay, I don't want to do video games or movies. Maybe I can do like music reviews. And there was this another creator, Brad Jones, and he had this thing that I really enjoyed where he would taste snacks and he would, and this was before like React was really like a thing, and he would react live, well, to tape, he would react how these different snacks tasted. And I thought, oh, maybe I could do that, but for music. And then I called my old roommate, college buddy, and he had a camera and a tripod. And we used his stuff for some reason. I'm trying to remember why now. I might not have had, actually, now that I think about it, I probably didn't have all the equipment I have now. That's right, because, it's funny to think back.
Yeah, like building the plane as you fly it kind of approach.
Yeah. But I had like a micro, I had a Radio Shack microphone that just plugged in, like a little lavalier, like kind of like this. And yeah, we just shot like 7 episodes. No, I must have had a camera because, yeah, I probably had just gotten my first DSLR that could also do video, I think. Because, yeah, I did the intro. It's so weird to think back. Yeah. But that I shot that towards the end of 2010. And I quickly learned that the reaction wasn't that interesting to watch. Because there was a lot of like, oh, that's interesting. But it was just like, I mean, now people do it. Mm-hmm. But at the time, maybe I hadn't figured it out yet, but I realized I was much more engaged if I was talking about the record and maybe a little bit of history and that sort of is like how it started. And then how we got to this is my buddy Josh saw what I was doing, and he's a production designer by trade. So he designs like film sets and like objects that go in film. And so he has a real design sense. So he had this whole idea like, well, what if we did it and did it this way? And then, so if you go back to my earliest episodes, it was just like on a kitchen table. And then it turned into like I used the house that I was living at. We kind of dressed it a certain way. And then eventually we built the first section of the set, but I had to, they're like panels, which is how they do it in film. You know, mm-hmm. They have these panels set up, but it would take like almost 3.5 hours to put it up and take it down in total. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it ate a lot of the day. And then even then, like I would have to like memorize everything I talked about. So it was very laborious. So just over the years, I've sort of refined it down to kind of what it is.
Make it real tight. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And even now I'm still trying out different ideas, and just, it's so interesting. You know, we could get in the nuts and bolts of it, but like, it's so interesting. Like it almost doesn't matter what your content is as much as like the title and thumbnail. Like
it's dead to real, my friend. That is so true. And you could, and I'm sure you've experienced this, something you've put a lot of energy and thought and planning in, and then it's out there and it's a dud. But then something that's just kind of spur of the moment, and you've got the right name, thumbnail, and something that took you hardly any time, and then it's a rocket ship. It's the wildest thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've sort of experienced, like I did this Is Elvis Alive conspiracy theory video. And it did fine when it first came out. I was happy with it. I think maybe it cleared 100,000 views within the first couple of months. And then all of a sudden it like shot up like a rocket ship, and I traced it back and I realized, oh, that's when the first Baz Luhrmann Elvis trailer dropped.
Oh, sure. So he kind of
and now it's one of my top most viewed videos. It's really interesting, and it actually for some reason it pays the best too. It's so funny.
Thank you, King, wherever you are.
Thank you. Yeah, but that's the other thing too. Yeah, I mean, it's so volatile. Like it's really difficult to make this your job. So
for sure. Talking about, you know, the thought process early on, because one thing that is definitely stands out to me, and I'm sure a lot of people who watch your channel, is the aesthetic of what I'll call your lair. Now, is that a static place in your home? Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because obviously the wood paneling and the look is clearly very intentional. It's very cool.
Yeah.
Where did that kind of come from?
I mean, credit to Josh. I mean, his whole idea was, I mean, we had a lot of ideas early on, but it was never meant to be like I'm from the past. It was just more like, why don't we embrace, because this was, 2012. So even at that time, records were starting to come back, mm-hmm. but you know, we sort of agreed that, you know, the mid 70s was sort of like the peak of the album and the vinyl. Like, you know, you have Pioneer turntables and like this, the type of speakers that people had, and you had these sort of really nice man caves, and sort of like the album really as a package really came into its own. I feel like you had a lot of really nice, almost every record was a gatefold, and then you had Zeppelin and other people. I think Santana even had a crazy fold out thing. Zeppelin had some really cool cutout. Alice Cooper just had ridiculousness with almost every, there was a period there with panties included. So like there was like that whole thing. So it was like, well, let's create that vibe. Let's create that mood for viewers and do something different than what's on YouTube in general. Sort of create a space where even if you're not, you don't have the sound on, you're like, what is this? Like, this is interesting. And initially there was a intention to have the, you know, quote unquote performance, the way I deliver the information in a tongue in cheek kind of manner. Almost our inspiration was like Guy Smiley from Sesame Street.
Okay.
Sort of like, you're not really sure if the guy, if he's like making fun of you or what.
Okay.
And I think it rubbed people the wrong way initially. And also, truth be told, I really didn't know as much as I know now when it comes to like history. I had a very narrow piece of music knowledge. Now it's much more expanded, but it's funny when I go back to some earlier stuff and it's like, what? But that's just the process, man. Like I sort of like became the vinyl geek just from just a unquenchable thirst of knowledge and curiosity that I have. So, but it is kind of it's a whole, you know, now I'm sort of locked into this look. So sometimes it's like, oh man. And it was weird during COVID to have long hair. Cause I've always been curious to grow up my hair.
Mm-hmm.
And COVID kind of gave me that opportunity. And then like, well, how does the geek still live with this guy with a ponytail? And I made it work, and some people didn't actually know, but if I turned my head, you could see. I mean, I had a fat bun there, but it's weird, man. Like for me personally, I don't like myself with clean shaven face and long hair. It just, I don't know. It just didn't work for me. It was fine with like a beard.
Preaching to the choir, my friend. Preaching to the choir. I get it.
Yeah. So I don't know. It was good to cut all that off, but it does become like it's a thing. It almost becomes a ritual in itself, just like putting the record on the turntable and stuff.
Yeah.
Doing this show can be that. And sometimes, you know, I like to try to match my outfit to, not always, but I like to try to match my outfit to what I'm talking about, or at least draw some parallels. It just sort of helps me pick out what tie, to be honest, because I have a lot of ties. So
fair enough. Yeah. When you were starting out in terms of, once you kind of centered on the lane of like talking about music, doing music reviews, vinyl reviews and so forth.
Yeah.
Did you kind of crowdsource and kind of look out in the vinyl community, air quotes, about other people and other channels to see maybe there's best practices or ideas you could glean as you kind of formed your own kind of presentation?
Yeah. Most of what a lot of the inspiration initially was, the Nostalgia Critic and the Angry Video Game Nerd, in terms of like how to present it. And at that time, there were people doing music reviews. I mean, the Needle Drop was definitely around then. I think at the time he probably had like a 250,000 subscribers.
Sure.
You know, he was like he still is.
The guy, yeah.
But yeah, he, you know, that was a thing. But I was like, okay, well, he's the Needle Drop, but he really doesn't talk about vinyl. I mean, he has sense. Obviously, he has some vinyl-centric things. He's got a stack of records behind him, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the thing I noticed is that most people weren't actually talking, weren't like they were reviewing the music, but they weren't
necessarily format specific. Sure.
Yeah, or like reviewing the quality of the pressing. And there was another guy, I think, I want to say like the Vinyl Guru or the Daily. It was somebody who uploaded every day. And I was like, wow, I don't know if I could do that. He had long hair. I forget his name, but it was like Guru. There was a Guru name in it. Might have been the Daily Guru. I don't know. But, and then there, yeah, I did catch on very early on with the vinyl community, but there was something I wanted it to be a little bit more, I wanted it to be more, I don't want to say written necessarily, but I wanted it to have
balance, structure. Is that
less like a ramble and more like specific?
Yeah, discipline to it. Sure.
Yeah, not just a show and tell, and not just. I mean, I did in the early days. I think at least one response video to somebody, but I never truly felt a part of the community in terms of like keeping up with people and replying sense. Like I felt like I was always on the periphery, but that was just by my own choice. It was nothing like I never felt any bad blood or anything. And I would occasionally watch people's videos, maybe comment, but yeah, I wasn't that actively engaged. I felt like I was doing something adjacent, but not something a little different.
Yeah. That makes sense. 100%. Yeah. I think there's different. That's kind of, since I've been involved, I'm one of these guys who watched for a long time. And again, like you said, the show and tell, it has value in certain respects, but then there was other things that kind of drew me into the actual viewer part of it, the viewer component.
Yeah.
And I always appreciate somebody who, I always say this on the other shows, the vinyl community is a lot more than YouTube. It's a lot more than your local record store. Like it is an expanse, but there's also different people participate in different ways. Just like you're kind of talking about is, there's, the people who comment on every video, the Melinda Murphys who put out the video and God bless her.
Yeah.
Every single thing. I can't do that. Just like you said, the guy before doing a video every single day, that's a bandwidth I don't have, but, but I think it's, in whatever way we're showing the passion or enthusiasm or, just appreciation for the format. I mean, make your own lane. That's the way I kind of look at it.
Yeah. I mean, and early on, I really liked, there's a channel, Baraka P Dub.
Paul, yeah. Paul, great guy.
Yeah. He, I really enjoyed his knowledge because I believe he's an engineer.
He's a NASA man. He is a NASA. He's smarter than all of us to put together.
Yeah. So I really like his expertise and just sort of his scientific approach. Cause he does do the vinyl community type videos, but then he'll do like, well, here's my five pressings of Led Zeppelin 2. And like, here are my thoughts. And like, I really like his approach to videos, which definitely inspired a lot of my videos. And then also I think, I don't know if he's necessarily considered part of it, but Pop Goes the 60s. I like a lot of what he's doing as well. But for me, part of what happens is, I don't want to inadvertently like plagiarize somebody else. So I don't end up watching a lot of other YouTube channels in the same genre that I do, especially when it comes to like the needle drop. I also I don't want to be unintentionally influenced. Sometimes after I do my review, I might go watch what he has to say, but,
makes sense.
I guess I'm just, also I'm a bit of a gamer too. So I try to
wait, you're not all about records. This is over. You have other interests. Come on, Eric.
I know.
No, I appreciate that. In terms of the content you're putting out, is there a process or do you have like a, generally speaking, high level, like way you come about the idea and then kind of how you pen to paper it? Do you kind of just have like a thought tree and then say, okay, now I got to set the time up, do it, put it out. Like, how's your process work?
Yeah, it's, it depends. Like I have a Google Doc of like ideas that I've written down, maybe like a sentence or like the title of something. And then I try to like, I can be very random, but once I like zero in on something, I'm like, oh, I have to write about this. Like I just learned about these Kiss themed coffins or caskets. And I was like, okay, I have to look into this. And then, you know, sometimes what's presented is like, not, there's not a lot to the story. So then it's like, okay, well maybe I can do something different with it. But generally speaking, when it comes to the more like documentary style videos, like of how something came to be or like a history of something, it usually starts with just like going to Wikipedia and just sort of hitting like the beats. Okay, what is the overall global picture of this idea? And then I'll scroll to the bottom and start looking at the sources. And then I'll go to the sources and like start reading out more about that. And then I always try to ask myself why. Like I just finished writing this piece on Ringo for President, and that was just inspired by a Reddit post. Someone said like, what's the deal with Ringo for President? Like kids in 1964 were actively picketing with signs, and they went to the Republican National Convention in San Francisco and were picketing and like chanting in the streets in New York. Like it was a whole thing. And there was even a song made about it, which I have right here.
Look at that. Showing records on a record talk. Yes. My man.
And you know, who co-wrote this is Mort Garson, who did the Plantasia album.
No kidding. Okay.
And then these two guys also wrote Our Day Will Come by Ruby and the Romantics. So it's just like bizarre when you go down these rabbit holes of information. Yes. And it's like, okay, but why did these kids pick Ringo? And that was like a late addition. Because I'm like, of all the Beatles, why did they pick him? And, sure. You know, it's not an easy question. It's not like I can just like say, oh, let me give him a call and find out.
Right.
You know? So it's, I mean,
he was just an amoeba the other day, so you didn't try to set up a one-on-one.
Yeah, I could probably get to him through Colin Hay, or at least get Colin to ask him. But even I don't even think he knew, you know. And like, right. Anyway, long story short, like I try to find as much information as I can, and I often like to go to like publications of the day. If I can, there's some really good resources out there, like especially of old Billboard magazines. Those are really interesting to kind of thumb through, PDF versions. But yeah, usually because of what I write will eventually be spoken, I often will voice to text write, because I find like, because there's a, well, not, I re- recently realized not everyone has a voice in their head, which is interesting.
Okay.
But you know, like it's weird, but it's true. But basically if you write silently and just sort of type what you're thinking, that's your head voice. And there's like certain things you can do in something that's being read. Like you can say the former or the latter. But you can't really do that in speech, nor would you. That's kind of an odd thing, because you can't go back and like, wait, what was the former? Which one was the latter? Like, I don't remember. So that helps in the writing process. It also is just, it gets the ideas out quicker. Mm-hmm. But some voice to text messes up. And so I read back through. I'm like, what was that? But that's especially helpful when I do an album review. Like I'm working on Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, and I'm just having the song play, and I'm just throwing out how I think about certain things. It's just easier to just speak that. Mm-hmm. Also, I find like when I'm explaining to my friends what I'm working on, sometimes I'll explain it more succinctly and simply just by talking it out loud, and I can get convoluted and long-winded when I try to write things out. It's always a battle for me. I find I can try to be too detailed, and I'm trying to always simplify things. And also I try to keep in mind that not everyone watching is from, you know, the US. And so I try to avoid like colloquialisms, and I try to be more, not that I'm like a super highfalutin type person, but I try to not use like very complicated words, or I try to not use like random analogies. I try to keep it more universal and basic. And I also try to keep it sort of timeless in a sense. If that makes sense. Cause I know like there's just certain ways of speaking, because I know like someone might be watching this video in 2024, they might be watching it 5 years from now. So to say something came out 50 years ago, it doesn't quite,
math, it doesn't work. Right.
Yes. But if you say, you can say decades ago
or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Well, yeah. Usually what I'll do is I say like, 2024 marks the 50th anniversary. So that's easy to like do the math if you're watching it 6 years from now. Like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So it's about 56. Okay, cool. Just things like that is sort of how my process works. And ultimately I'm just trying to tell a story. I'm not trying to like bait and switch or clickbait, but you kind of have to like tease the audience.
You got to massage the story for sure.
Yeah. You got to pique people's interest to get them to click. It's a balance, and that's always a struggle. And then it's like, ultimately you can't please everybody. And, I think at the end of the day, you have to just kind of do what you're most proud of or what you think is the best, and just move on to the next video.
That was one of the hardest things for me to learn in this whole process is, cause exactly what you're talking about, trying to do the best that I can do.
Yeah.
Other people do it better and good for them. But when you get some of that kind of the periphery noise or in the comments, and it is a little strange because, if you get something wrong, so be it, great, correct me, et cetera. But some people just live just to push buttons. And I'm sure you probably had to learn that as you were kind of standing up your process and your channel, just because it's like, okay, well, on to the next.
Yeah.
How did you kind of put up blinders or put up shields where you just continue to move forward on that stuff?
Yeah, it's just funny with comments, because like, there could be 1,000 very nice comments or, generally cordial, but then you'll get the one that just, I don't know, rubs you the wrong way. And it's like, that's like all
stepping on a Lego. Yeah, right.
That's all you think about. So yeah, I usually have like friends or other people like look at the comments, because it's just
good
to help me kind of like filter through it sometimes. Because yeah, it is, it can be detrimental. It can like really set you back, which is, I don't know. It's such a funny thing. So definitely early on, the comments certainly helped. I would say, because I did make a lot of mistakes. Like one of the ones I can't really live down is pronouncing Greenwich, Greenwich in my Jimi Hendrix video,
Sure. How dare you, Eric?
And also, it's like a catch 22 sometimes. Like, people from Melbourne call it Melbourne, But for me, it's like, if English speaking people pronounce it a certain way, I'm going to probably try to pronounce it the way they will. It's sort of like, you don't call it Louisville, you call it Louisville.
Right.
For Kentucky, right? It's just, I don't know. But, people.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't. I'm with you.
Yeah. So it's just, you kind of have to just, you can't be indecisive. You just got to decide. Or you can just acknowledge, like, hey, some people say it this way, I'm going to say it this way. That's another way you can kind of.
Sure.
Cause to be, especially like I realized this researching a lot of Pink Floyd stuff, is like all four. Well, I'm not really counting Sid, but all four of the guys, they all have their own accounts. And so it's hard to say which one is definitive, right? Mm-hmm. Cause they're all true, but they all conflict. So it's, instead of like picking a side, you just try to acknowledge that, like, this is what, David said, this is what Richard said. So, somewhere the truth lies, but
somewhere in the center. Let's talk about the vinyl piece of this and specifically your vinyl. I don't want to say obsession, but you know, like you have to have a strong passion for the format to have this as a, you know, a strong component of your channel. Where did that start for you? Like in terms of amassing a music collection or a record collection, like walk us through that.
Yeah. I mean, records have always, I mean, as long as I can remember, records were in my life. Like I had two older brothers and my mom and dad, they all had it. We all had records in the house and it was all kind of in one area in this cabinet that was low enough that little 3-year-old Eric could like look at the covers. My brothers, I remember, would make copies of the records onto cassette, not always mixtapes, just like a copy of it so they could listen to it in the car. And sometimes I remember my big brother would pick me up and then he'd let me do some of the stuff like the dusting or I don't know if I ever got to put the needle down. I might have, or at least did the thing. So it was just felt like magic. So it was always been part of my life. But, you know, I came about when I was a preteen, you know, I was collecting mostly Weird Al stuff. And so that was primarily cassettes. Like say, you know, I got a cassette of Dare to Be Stupid and then I'd make a copy for my friend and he'd give me in 3D on cassette as a dub. And eventually, I remember like a couple of my friends went and saw Weird Al a couple of years before I did. And then he had an in 3D LP, autographed by Weird Al. I was like, oh, I want one of those. So I went and bought Even Worse and got it autographed in 94 at the Catalyst in Santa Cruz. He was backstage. And at the time it was interesting because Weird Al would do two shows. He would do an all ages show. And then he would do like a 21 and up show just because some of the venues, you know, really relied on the alcohol sales and but Weird Al knew a large part of his audience were kids. So some of these venues, that's what he would do. So we caught the early show and in between he was signing autographs, in this like parking lot area, but it was caged in. So like his bus was there, but then like that was sort of backstage and you could hang out there and maybe see him. So he came out and talked to us for a while. It was just one of those things. Like CDs were available. The Columbia Record House obviously was a thing. But they were just very expensive comparatively to like cassette and even a record. So you just sort of like, well, and also like our cars didn't have CD players. So it was just like, what are you going to get? You know, might as well just get the record because it's $5 at the local record shop. And then I can just make a cassette from that and actually make a, you know, put a couple albums on there. And so it sort of just came out that way because that was the only way you could get a lot of this music or hear this music. And then my parents were always going to garage sales. And so as my interest started changing from like getting toys, it was like music. And I would look through record collections and my dad, at the time he owned a flooring store. And so he would go to people's homes and he went to this one home and he said, Eric, you got to come down here. This was like, I must've been able to drive. Yeah. This might've been like 99. And I say that because I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but I just remember this distinctly. It was like the first time I just got to dig. Like seriously dig through records. This older couple, they were just letting go of a lot of stuff and they had just stacks and stacks of records that I could just take whatever I wanted. And I remember a lot of this stuff was like a lot of crooners and like pop from the 50s and 60s and classical, but they also had a large collection of Exotica stuff. And I had never seen some of this. So I was like, oh, this is cool. There was something very alluring about it. But even before then, I should back up a little bit, but like in 95, 96, I started getting in, or I guess it was 97. I started getting into like going to thrift stores and like finding cool clothing and stuff. And after a while you would do kind of the round and you'd just end up at the records just to kind of see what kind of funny covers there were. Cause I was all about initially like buying up stuff I thought was funny or like just to show people. Cause I like to, show people things or educate my friends like, hey, did you know Eddie Murphy put out a single or like Don Johnson had an album,
Bruce Willis or something.
Yeah. So I love that Bruce Willis album. And so, yeah, that was sort of a natural thing where I would just like, even this suit was from a thrift store, this tie, you know, it was just like, and I would make, like silly movies with my friends and I would edit them at the public television TV station. Hmm. It was all like VCR to VCR, but they call them VTRs, you know, the kind of a higher end thing. We do put things on SVHS and eventually you'd be able to broadcast them on the local channel. So like that was my YouTube before YouTube.
Pre-YouTube, love it.
Yeah. But yeah, so it just started, you know, so for I would say for a long time I was collecting kind of weird off the wall stuff because I was heavily influenced by like Weird Al and Dr. Demento, and I would often just get stuff for cheap. I really wasn't going to a lot of record stores to dig. Mostly when I went to a record store it was to find something specific, like I really need this album, or we would like go to the record store before going to the movie, so we would just kind of browse. Like I really wasn't gonna like buy this or that. And so like, I wasn't, you know, looking back now, I kind of wish I expanded a little bit more, but I was really just into like comedy stuff, weird album covers and like classic rock. I really wasn't thinking of, you know, maybe I should get some of this early 90s stuff that is available on vinyl. Cause at that time it would have been way cheaper than it is now. But I wasn't really thinking like a collector. I was just like collecting what was interesting to me. But then when YouTube did come into the picture, suddenly I felt like a lot of this stuff I had really wasn't, I could just share someone the video of it. I didn't really need to own it. And around that time, this would have been, you know, like 06, 07, I was deciding like, I think I'm going to move to LA. And so I wanted to lighten my burden. I didn't want to have so much stuff in storage. So I cut my vinyl collection in half, but I did really miss it. But honestly, I didn't really, the only thing I remember selling that I kind of wish I had was a Talking Heads album. The clear one. I think it was Speaking in Tongues or something.
Yeah. Speaking in Tongues with the rounded. Yeah.
It's like a yeah. It wasn't in great shape, but I got it from a garage sale. But I did keep like my Dramarama, which I got at a garage sale, the Cinema Verte. It's got the anything song on there. It's a great album. That and the follow-up album are really great. But yeah, I just never, unfortunately, it never really occurred to me to kind of go after the more collectible stuff. Like I was kind of stuck in like 50s and, you know, I had some Elvis stuff. I had some Buddy Holly, but, you know, like I felt like the Gene Vincent album was really too price prohibitive for me. I never spent a lot of money on my albums. I generally would just find them at garage sales or thrift stores, and occasionally I would pick one up at the local record shop, but it was not very often. And it just, as the channel started growing, then I started to expand more as a collector and as a music listener. And I always collected Beatles stuff, but then I was really interesting to check out like all the different versions of Beatles albums, even in the US. And then I was like, wait a minute, there's ones that are different in the UK. And that like threw me for a loop. And so then I started getting really interested in like the regional differences. and the types of pressings, and just stuff started snowballing after that. And there was a point in time where I was like going like three times a week at different thrift stores, and just like, and I got some good stuff. But I think in the end, what I realized was like, I was sort of compensating, as opposed to doing like the hard work and like researching and creating interesting videos. I thought by going to these thrift stores and buying a bunch of records to then talk about on my channel, I thought that was like moving the channel forward, but it really wasn't. And in the end, a lot of those records, when I did like another culling of my collection recently, a lot of those records weren't in great condition, unfortunately. Like I should have been more picky, or maybe I've just grown more picky over the years. Like, I don't mind pops and crackles, but when it's like a deep scratch, it's just hard to want to keep that record. And like, you know, there are a few that I still got very lucky, like a Alice Coltrane album that I got for a couple bucks. You know, there are, you can still find some good stuff. Like, I'm still surprised I got this, that Nick Drake Pink Moon original pressing at a thrift store for a couple of dollars. That's in decent shape. But now I'm not nearly as active when it comes to that stuff.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you is, you know, with the vinyl renaissance, I'm using air quotes there. And then obviously the hobby growing exponentially in the last 8 to 10 years, like, where are you like finding records? Like, obviously outside the Nick Drake, like, the, at least where I'm from, and for other areas and other collectors I talk to, I mean, the well is drier in terms of finding like high quality pieces at thrifts, Goodwills, that sort of thing. So like, where now you are in kind of, you know, in California, there's a very fertile ground of, you know, shops that have used, you know, we talked about Amoeba, Atomic, there's so many, right? Permanent Records, another good one. Where are you finding records more often than not these days?
Yeah. See, the thing with me is like, I had some life events come up that put me in a position of some debt. So I had to cut back a lot.
Sure.
You know, like, nothing awful or anything, but, you know, moving through a divorce, it can be uncomfortable. And like, it's, you go from a dual income household to a single income, and then combine that with like these industry strikes, and then the way that the post COVID boom of YouTube advertising really fell off. So I was just like, you know, so I found myself kind of like, well, I can't buy as much. So that definitely affected, but also I would say as I get older, the need for me to like have it on vinyl sort of diminishes.
Okay.
I think I'm moving more towards like an all killer, no filler type collection. Like, I just want the albums that I absolutely love as a way to sort of like, oh yeah, like, this is a reflection of me, as opposed to I may talk about that album where I think it's like I have to have one of everything, and or one of an example of every genre of music, just to show like my credibility as someone who talks about music. But I realized like it collections, whatever you want it to be, it doesn't have to be this or that. And then also I realized I used to think I had to have the physical object in order to talk about it. And I've realized that the audience will accept it either way. Depending on the type of content, obviously if I'm talking about different pressings, it's important to have them. But even then it's like, I have done a buyer's guide based on like what other people have said on like Steve Hoffman or Discogs. So it's not necessarily, it's just how you approach it. Like, I could talk about all these really interesting pressings that are out there. I don't have to have all of them. So like, all of that stuff sort of influences me today when it comes to going out there and shopping for vinyl. My favorite place right now is a store called Record Safari.
Yeah, Alex Rodriguez's spot. Yep.
Yeah. Great space, you know, really, you know, well priced, good selection. And the store is like not too big, not too small. And there's always something interesting there. Like you can just browse the new arrivals and find something you want to take home. And that's often what I'll do. And it's like, so, you know, I'm still going through my collection. So every once in a while I'll bring in a small stack of records to trade in. And, I will often walk away with cash and maybe a record. Like I recently found 4 Minute Mile by the Get Up Kids. And I love that album as a teenager. So it was like important for me to have it on vinyl. Sure. And sometimes I come across duplicates. And then recently I was at this thrift store, St. Vincent de Paul. It's like one of the largest mm-hmm. in LA. And I didn't even want to look through the vinyl, but I was like, I'll check it out. And I came across some really cool records, like this one that's ridiculous. It's a series where they take, like, I wouldn't even call her famous, but they took this actress and then they give you a script and she says her lines and then you can say your lines. And so there's enough space in between and they have like sound effects and a narrator. Sure. It's really funny. Like that was a fun purchase. And then I found this like couple disco albums, like a funk disco right. funk album. Just so random. Like I guess it's one of those things when you stop like hunting all the time, sometimes things will just jump out at you. But mostly it's just that one record store, Record Safari. Mm-hmm. I did go to Permanent Records recently, but only to see a band. I went to the Roadhouse. Yeah, great venue. I think I should mention that because of my position, I am in this unique place where often I will get promo copies. Right. So that also has an effect. Granted, would I buy a lot of these records? You know, maybe not. It is very lucky to be able to like listen to new music on vinyl first. Like not everyone has that luxury, and it does change how I listen to it. Cause sometimes I'll preview it on Spotify and then I'll throw on the record and I was like, oh, you know, it sounds different, even though it doesn't make any sense, but it affects me differently. I really enjoy that. So, but again, yeah, a lot of the stuff that gets sent to me is not always stuff that I would pick out, but I always like to give everything a listen and to give back. And granted, you know, they are promo copies, but there's still a lot of work involved. Listening to it a couple, like 2 or 3 times, putting together a video, writing, even just 1 minute reviews, it takes a little bit. And also to come up with different ways of talking about an album and giving it, you know, not just like coasting through it, but actually talking about it. There's definitely some work involved. So, but it's funny, when I first started the channel, I was like, yeah, I'm going to get free records. But now it's like, that's not why I do it at all.
Of course.
Yeah.
I'm with you. All right. Well, Eric, we're rounding third, to borrow a baseball term. We've hit the heavy lift, and let's end this one on a fun note with the lightning rounds. A couple quick. Easy peasy questions. Let's start with this one. Talking about looking for records. Can you recall the number one find in the wild that blew your mind, gave you the most joy? Like, there's got to be, like, I always call it the oh shit moment. You're like, oh,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, is there one that kind of comes to the forefront for you?
Well, yeah, that recent Pink Moon, Nick Drake album. Because I was just in a Salvation Army thrift store in the back corner. I thought I was on a prank video. I Did looked you look around. I'm like, this can't be real. Like, or there's
Tom
something.
Tom Bergeron walks around the corner and he's like, here.
But yeah, like I just figured something was really wrong with it. Like, why would this be here? Like, it just didn't make any sense. Like, I thought those days were over. Like, I remember somebody found a really early press, like they since changed it on the official release, but it was an early press of Free Will and Bob Dylan, and it had completely different tracks on. It was a promo copy. It's like someone found that in a thrift store. Like it was like one of those moments. Granted, it's not as valuable, but the other moment I had like that is I used to back in the day before Discogs, you had the Gold Mine record collecting books. You know, like phone books, thick, heavy, hard to bring around in the thrift store, took you forever to look something up. And they weren't that detailed, right? Not as much as Discogs. And I remember in the center, they had color pages, and it was all about the Butcher album and Yesterday and Today by the Beatles. And I was I was kind of learning this. This goes back to like learning about the different pressings and how there's different Beatles albums, yada, yada. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. And in the book, you can like put a little check next to the album you have, right?
Like a baseball card checklist.
Yeah. So I, for like a good couple of years, I thought I just had a regular Yesterday and Today, but then I was flipping through the brand new edition, like the 9th edition of Goldmine. I was like, wait a minute. Huh, Ringo's turtleneck. And I like pull mine out and I'm like, and then I notice like on the bottom corner, it's starting to peel up. You can kind of see it. And I was like, oh man, this is it. This is so, and suddenly this $20 record is now $300 record or whatever. But that made me like pay attention way more to like different pressings and like that whole collecting aspect, which I wasn't even aware of. Like, obviously, as a kid, I'd collect different movie cards. My brothers had baseball cards, but like, I didn't really think of LPs in the same vein, But suddenly I was like, oh, wow, so crazy. So that, original pressing versus a reissue and this and that. Like, suddenly just my mind went obviously down this analog rabbit hole, basically.
Well, you bring up Discogs, kind of the next one I had for you is obviously. I always call it the best worst thing that's happened to the hobby, because obviously information being at your fingertips is invaluable, but then also the pricing kind of gets out of whack and so forth. So present day, any idea how big your Discogs want list is, or do you even use that feature?
Oh, I do it. Yeah, I do use it. I don't know how big it is, honestly. I do add things to, let's see, want list. Let's see if it'll tell me. I'm using the app. I know it's play-by-play. Really exciting here.
He's using the app.
Yeah.
He's scrolling.
It doesn't seem to tell
Yeah, I don't think it does it through the app. The only place I see the number is generally on like a desktop or something like that. But ballparking. Do you think you're in the – oh, here we go. Yeah. You're in the minis.
But the problem is, like, I will often put multiple – because I don't really care if it's a UK pressing or it's like whatever works. Like I'll pick it out. And sometimes I'm like, why did I pick this? Like this must have been a cool record. I don't know, but there must have been a reason I picked this
out. Cold Heat. Okay. Yeah.
Ethel Azama, 1960. I don't know. There must have been something I heard. And then for some reason, I've been wanting this Daryl and Oates album.
Hall and Oates. Yeah, with the makeup. Yep.
Yeah. But I have yet to find that.
It's out there. Don't overpay on that one. That one will pop up. I guarantee. George Foreman.
Yeah.
That one will pop up.
I know. Oh, I eventually got this, but I got a repress of that one.
Okay. I can't see the title. What is it?
Oh, it's Eden Abbez Nature Boy, but it goes for quite a bit.
Whoa, yeah.
Why does it not adjust? Oh, there we go.
I saw the hundreds. Okay, yeah. Oh, daddy.
Yeah. It's a pricey one because it was released on Delphi Records, which is sort of a regional Southern California label in the 60s that mostly released surf music.
Okay.
And this was his only album. He's famous for writing the song Nature Boy. That Nat King Cole kind of made famous. And then Moulin Rouge years later made kind of famous again. So
Salute. All right, last one I got for Eric. Now I release you into the wild. talk about your program, because you've done interviews on your channel before.
Yeah.
Is there a dream guest or a project?
Weird Al.
Eventually? Is it weird? Oh, man, you didn't even get that.
And then, you know, but the problem is, like, you know, you might think I would say, like, Ringo or Paul, but it's like, I don't know. What do you, I mean, imagine you have Paul McCartney instead of this schlep, and you're like, what do you even ask the dude, right? What hasn't he already been asked?
Right.
Like, you mean you
right.
could ask him, well, what would you have for breakfast today, Paul?
Right, right.
You know, do you prefer bullet trains or planes? You know, it's like, what, I don't know. Like, and like people even say there's fans that list his different stories, and there's like, today on the Tonight Show, he told story 22A, you know, and it's just like he has these like stock things, and it's funny. Apparently there's a hand gesture or something that he does that's kind of his way of saying F you, but without actually saying, I forget what it is, but yeah. So I don't even go there, you know, at this point. But hey, if Paul wants to hang out, we'll hang out.
Hey, Paul McCartney, a big friend of the show, no doubt about it. Sir Paul,
yeah.
Let's make it happen. But if not, Weird Al, who also friend of the show, folks, let's make it happen. Good stuff. Well, let's wind it down now. Again, had a lot of fun and really look forward.
Thank you. Talking.
I appreciate answering the call. I send out these random emails, and people probably see them and are like, who's this jabroni? But I got one. No, Eric Valero, the channel is Vinyl Rewind. Look in the show notes. I'll have all the information about it. It's a great channel. And, you know, some things I've really enjoyed, I didn't really talk about this, is like you talk about the history of the album. Like, I remember you did the one on Pink Floyd, The Wall. I learned so much
because
like you said, you put so much thought and intentional focus into telling these stories that there are things that I thought I know a lot about it, and you unearth a lot of things. So highly recommend checking out the channel. Also, I believe a Vinyl Storage Solution fan. Is that your outer sleeve by choice?
Oh yeah. I love his products. Yeah.
Friend of the show, Vinyl Storage Solution.
Yeah. So
we have that in common as well. But anyway, Eric Calero, Vinyl Rewind. Thanks for joining us, sir.
Thank you. All right. Take care. See ya.
And that was another trip around the turntable. Thanks for listening to Vinyl Community Podcasts.